Coming up on Tech News Today, why LavaBit really shut down in the face of an Edward Snowden investigation. Also, Amazon's 3D phone interface and Facebook's building a village. All that and more coming up.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Tech News Today for Thursday, October 3rd, 2013. Tech News Today is brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website or online portfolio. For a free trial and 10% off, go to squarespace.com and use offer code TNT10. And by Personal Capital. With Personal Capital, you'll finally have all your financial life in one place and get a clear view of everything you own. Best of all, it's free. To sign up, go to personalcapital.com/TNT. Welcome to Tech News Today. I'm Tom Merritt.
I'm Sarah Lane.
I'm Maya Zachter.
I'm Jason Howell.
And this is the show where we try to keep you up to date on the most important stories in the tech world, wrap them in a loving embrace of context, starting with the top 10 stories of the day in the news fuse. Bitcoin showed another characteristic of becoming a real currency yesterday when Silk Road, a major Bitcoin-powered market, was seized by the U.S. government. Bitcoins dropped from around $140 a coin down to near $118 a coin. That's a big drop, but it's also what you'd expect when a major market for a currency disappears suddenly. Today, the coins have recovered somewhat to more than $120 per coin, just as you'd expect a currency to do as the marketplace rebalances. Meanwhile, Ross Ulbricht, alleged to be the Dread Pirate Roberts in charge of Silk Road, has been charged in Maryland with drug trafficking and the hiring of a hitman. Ulbricht was charged in New York yesterday on 3 counts of conspiracy.
Amazon is developing 2 smartphones, an inexpensive model, and one with 3D eye tracking interface, sources tell TechCrunch. The expensive one reportedly has that 3D user interface, eye tracking, and other goodies, and is going by the name Project Smith. The screen itself isn't 3D, but the device features 4 cameras, one at each corner of the device that would be used to track eye and head motions in order to move the interface around to give the impression of 3D. However, a release is apparently not planned this year.
Google just bought itself gesture recognition tech company Flutter. TechCrunch says the deal was about $40 million. Flutter makes apps for both Windows and OS X and lets a user control their computers using their webcams. The Flutter team announced their acquisition on the front page of their site, saying they will be continuing their research at Google.
Court records were unsealed in the case of LavaBit, the encrypted email provider that folded in August rather than cooperate with federal investigators. The case shows LavaBit refused to decrypt one user's account, presumably Edward Snowden's account, in order to allow a pen register. The U.S. followed up with a search warrant demanding LavaBit's SSL private key, which would have opened all accounts to possible snooping. The U.S. promised in court they would only look at the one account they were after. LavaBit's Ladar Levison provided the key in a printout. The judge required that it be made available in electronic form, and LavaBit shut down rather than comply with the order.
Intel has partnered with Arduino to produce the Galileo Development Board, a product that uses Intel's Quark X1000 system on a chip. Intel isn't abandoning its x86 legacy, though. Quark's powered by a single-thread Pentium-based 400-megahertz CPU. As part of the new project, Intel will be handing out 50,000 of these boards to 1,000 universities over the next 18 months.
Foss Patents published court documents filed in the U.S. District Court for the Northern District of California that suggest Samsung may have been able to access information related to a confidential Nokia-Apple patent deal. Now, apparently, Apple provided confidential documents related to a Nokia-Apple patent deal to Samsung's outside attorney. The document specifically said that the terms of the deal were not to be disclosed by either party. Samsung's attorney then made the documents accessible to Samsung. The court wants to know more information and is looking to see Samsung emails and other communications to round out the story.
A Tesla S caught fire on Washington Route 167 Tuesday morning. The driver claimed the car hit something, although police could find no debris. The fire was limited to the front of the car, and nobody was injured. Coincidentally, the fire came as RW Baird analyst Ben Kahlo downgraded Tesla stock to neutral. Tesla stock prices then predictably fell.
Wow. That is Wow.
Yeah.
Temporary photo sharing app Snapchat has introduced a new feature called Stories that features images that don't disappear in seconds. Your new daily Snapchat story lets your friends view a collection of your snaps you've taken over the last 24 hours, after which they are gone for good. The stories will play back in the order they occurred, not in reverse chronological order. So if only Facebook updates had a shorter shelf life, they might be onto something.
Also, I think the words you were looking for earlier were "that Tesla's on fire."
Yes, I was distracted by the fire.
Fire! Anantech has completed an investigation after it was revealed that the Samsung Galaxy S4 detected the presence of benchmarking software and automatically drove CPU voltage frequency to their highest rate. Anantech found that, with the exception of Apple and Motorola, every manufacturer they've worked with ships at least one device with the same CPU voltage and frequency behavior, including the recently released Samsung Galaxy Note 3. Anantech's Anandlal Shrimpy and Brian Klug point out that the optimizations only gain about nothing to 5% for CPUs and maybe around 10% for GPUs, and the manufacturer's time might be better spent demanding actual better performance from silicon vendors.
The World Wide Web Consortium approved a charter that will allow DRM into HTML5. Now, the EFF had filed a formal objection saying that DRM was not within the scope of the charter. However, W3C Director Tim Berners-Lee concluded it was indeed within the scope of the charter, and the encrypted media extension proposal will be a part of the group's work. The EFF says it's deeply disappointed and argues by approving this idea, the W3C has ceded control of the user agent to a third party, the content distributor.
This episode of Tech News Today is brought to you by Squarespace. Squarespace is the all-in-one platform that makes it easy to create your own professional website or online portfolio. I use Squarespace for Merit Books, meritbooks.squarespace.com. I use it for Sword and Laser. Makes things easy. It's faster to update. It's reliable. I don't have to think about hosting. And they're constantly improving their platform. They just added 20 new beautiful templates for you to start with. All the style options you need to create a unique website for your business. And it's inexpensive. Starts at only $8 a month. That includes the mobile responsive design templates, the beautiful designs, the back-end support, the 24/7 availability of their support staff, the hosting, all of that, and a free domain name if you sign up for a year. Even their code is beautiful. We all know Squarespace looks great on the outside, but what is also amazing is that code inside is beautiful too. Squarespace takes just as much pride in the elegance of their back-end code as they do in their front-end design. Start a trial with no credit card required. Start building your website today. When you decide to sign up for Squarespace, make sure to use the offer code TNT10 to get 10% off and to show your support for Tech News Today. We thank Squarespace for their support of Tech News Today. Squarespace, everything you need to create an exceptional website. Joining us now to gather around the old round table and discuss the stories of the day, Mr. Scott Budman, business and tech reporter for NBC in the Bay Area. How's it going, Scott? Good to have you back, man.
Very well. Thank you. Good to be with you guys.
Well, let's start off talking about Lava a bit. I'll run through the timeline real quickly here, and then I want to hear what you guys have to say. Kevin Poelsel laid it out pretty well in an article on Wired. You can read the unsealed documents yourself if you want to. June 28th, Lava Bit was served with a pen register and trap and trace order. You just need a subpoena for that. You just need a judge to sign off on it. You do not need to show probable cause. So they went to Lava Bit. They said, we want from and to lines. We want IP addresses. Lava Bit offers encryption. So Ladar Levinson agreed to install the pen register and the trap and trace, but declined to circumvent the account's user-enabled encryption. That caused the feds to go back to court. U.S. Magistrate Judge Teresa Buchanan ordered compliance, threatened criminal contempt if Lava Bit did not comply. July 9th, prosecutors asked for a summons and requested Levinson be held in contempt. July 16th, they finally came back with an actual search warrant. Requesting all information necessary to decrypt communications sent to or from the Lava Bit email account of the person we presume is Edward Snowden, including encryption keys and SSL keys. Well, the problem with the SSL key is that's the same SSL key for every user of Lava Bit. So August 1st, Levinson fought that demand in a closed-door hearing with Claude M. Hilton, senior U.S. District Court judge for the Eastern District of Virginia. The prosecutor said, "We can assure the court that the way this would operate, while the metadata stream would be captured by the device does not download," not sure how that works, "does not store," also not sure how that works, "and no one looks at it. It filters everything, and the back end of the filter, we get what we are required to get under the order." In other words, the 400,000 people who have accounts on Lava Bit would not be at risk of their data being seen by the federal officers because they promised not to look. And the judge said, so this will all be filtered out? Well, that seems reasonable to me, and ruled in favor of the prosecution. August 2nd, Leveson gave a 11-page printout in four-point type of the SSL key. The court said, no, you can't do that. We're going to fine you $5,000 a day beginning August 6th unless you actually hand over electronic copies of your SSL key. And on August 8th, Leveson shuttered love a bit. We know that story. He wouldn't say why at the time, but he said, you know, I just can't, I can't cooperate with this. Lavabit is still appealing their order in the Fourth Circuit, and the deadline for opening briefs in that is October 10th. So there's the layout of what have happened here. Scott, now that we know a few more details, does it change how you view what Lavabit did?
Not so much. And I don't want to oversimplify this, but it seems to me you've got 400,000 users. You have the other end that says, well, we need the data, but we're not going to look at it. Isn't this what we've been hearing all along from the government? I understand why the technology people on that side are nervous about it. And to go as far as to shut it down, that seems pretty extreme. But this may, in years to come, be seen as somewhat of a heroic move. What do you guys think?
I find the 11-page printout just kind of hilarious. The idea of giving the SSL key in a four-point type is like, yeah, we'll comply. Here you go. They were trying to try to make sure they were complying with the law, as well as saying, look, we really don't want to do this because we shouldn't have to. So I kind of applaud them for doing that and going to the lengths of shutting down to protect the users. That, I think, is above and beyond any company that you could ever think of. So I'm not really sure what to make of apart from that that bit of trivia.
I would like to see this go to the Supreme Court, because the 1970s Supreme Court ruling and the following laws have said that the reason that a pen register is okay is the fact that when you call a phone company, you don't have any expectation of privacy. Now, courts have also ruled the same thing with email in certain cases. But I think there's a difference here. You have an account that's encrypted by the user. That user, I would think, has an expectation of privacy at that point, right? This is different than, oh, well, if I make a phone call to the phone company, I know that the phone company is going to know my phone number. They have to know it to make the call. If I'm encrypting everything with a company, I'm assuming that the company doesn't know. And I have an expectation of privacy there. So I think that's where this hinges, and that's where this is different than your typical pen register trap and trace case. And I hope Lavabit keeps getting funded enough to fight this forward. Because like you said, Scott, this is another example, a small example of the government saying, we're doing this for a good purpose. We're only going after this one guy, but give us more information than we need and trust that we won't look at the rest of it.
I agree. And it's a very slippery slope, as we've already seen with these NSA cases. And I agree with what you said. I'd like to see this go further. I'd like to see some semblance of an actual decision on whether or not an encryption means your stuff is going to be safe. And there are 400,000 people here that are probably thinking just what you said. Hey, they said it was encrypted, and that is different from, you know, my AT&T account or my Google Plus account or something like that.
Correct. Yeah. That's a good point. Amazon phones. Always lots of rumors. Now they're even cooler rumors, I guess.
Yeah, so there was a Hacker News post by a brand new account by the name of Helvodka. And it's claiming lots of details of Amazon phones, and these bits were corroborated by TechCrunch, and it's also in line with the Wall Street Journal article from earlier this year in May. Helvodka says that there's one cheap Amazon phone similar to the Kindle Fire with its operating system, and that other version has that 3D UI that Sarah mentioned. It won't be released until next year. From the Hacker News post, it says, but the front of the phone has four cameras placed on each corner of the phone. This tracks the user's eyes and head to move the UI to give the impression of 3D, similar to what iOS 7 is achieving by using the phone's accelerometer. The advantage being that it's not based on how the phone moves, but how the head moves. There's been some software testing on a feature that will recognize the user's face, ignore other users, so that way it's only projecting the 3D to the user. And it's also supposed to be able to, I believe, recognize objects. So if you want to buy stuff on Amazon, Amazon wanted to launch it already, but apparently lost a bunch of key players from the company. Scott, would a 3D UI make an Amazon phone stand out? Because there's so much competition right now.
It's true. You know what sticks out to me the most is the photography, if you will, of objects. Remember, this is going to be a commerce device, I think. And you think about the Kindle. The Kindle was priced low so that it could be a commerce device for books. When Amazon started, it was a company that allowed you to buy books. This, I believe, is the commerce device, the piece of hardware that will let us buy everything else instantly. not just by shopping on Amazon, but by literally pricing everything by looking at it. We saw those kind of apps on phones from eBay and Amazon already that let you, you know, photograph something and instantly get information and find cheaper prices. So the 3D will be interesting and the interaction will be interesting. But I think this is a way that Amazon allows us to quickly press a button and buy everything else besides books. And by the way, maybe, you know, talk on the phone once in a while.
Is there some big advantage to having cameras, four cameras on the phone that are projecting out and taking the information that they're seeing in order to create the illusion of 3D? It seems like it's better quality control if it's something inside the phone rather than what the phone is seeing, mm-hmm. because and there's so many variables. I mean, is it super bright? Are there two people in the shot? Does the phone get confused? Obviously, they're testing that, but it seems like it seems wonkier, really, to build it that way.
I would think that the multiple cameras, kind of like the Kinect uses multiple cameras to get an inkling to figure out how many people are there. I believe the Kinect uses, I want to say, at least two cameras. So to have four to understand who's looking at it and try to determine the user, I think that's probably the most reasonable idea behind it. But otherwise, it does seem like it would add to battery drain. It seems like it'd be... If the only feature it's giving you is that you can have this cool 3D UI, I don't know if that's enough. If it somehow aids in object recognition, as the Hacker News Post mentions, like and Scott's mentioning, that if you can just look at an object and say, I want to buy that coffee mug that Sarah's got there, and I just have to look at it. If it can do that, maybe the four cameras help with that kind of thing. But I'm not really sure if this is going to stand out because there are phones from everybody. What's going to make Amazon's different? That you could buy stuff? Like, great, this thing takes my money. Yay.
Two things. I'm curious whether it would be a battery drain because it's just cameras. They're passive sensors unless it's shining lights up or something. Maybe the processing would be a battery drain. But secondly, you don't think that if I have a phone that when I look at it, things are floating above it and I can turn my head and look to the side of that thing without even turning the phone? You don't think that makes a phone stand out, Ayaz?
Well, maybe in a store. But I mean, if you're looking at it online, you're trying to buy an Amazon product, unless they have in-store experience, if you're just like, oh, look, when I look at my laptop, I can do this. Wow. But I mean, if they have an in-store experience, it'll stand out, I guess, slightly.
And Ayaz, you did mention the Kinect, and that reminds me, we've seen in some high-end stores those Kinect cameras, the 3D cameras that will take a picture of you to tell you your size of, let's say, a pair of jeans or a blouse and to get that right. So if somehow the phone can also detect what product you would be best to buy, not just the product itself, but something on your body, you'd be able to get that correct pair of jeans or that correct blouse much faster by, I don't know, pointing your phone at you somehow.
Scott, I like this idea. It's like, okay, it sees me. It's like, you need a trim. Here's a Norelco beard trimmer as your special offer. Sounds like a great idea.
You know what you need? A corncob pipe. That's okay. What you need.
You need a deer hunter hat. I think we got something here.
Oh, go ahead, sir.
I was just going to say the whole make 3D work thing probably applies best to something like an Amazon store, right? I mean, when you're sort of saying, ooh, there's some 3D-ish effects with icons, I mean, you notice it once and then you never care about it again. But as far as buying stuff, I could see how it could make that crock pot look just that much
nicer. Yeah, you're right, because you can actually look around the crock pot or any object. You go, okay, how does this look in dimension? That actually
see the ports on the back of the device you're buying, Ayaz. Does that not get you excited?
Because I could just kind of like tilt it and go, this doesn't look right. Oh, there's the HDMI port. Actually, that does seem pretty cool.
Uh-huh.
Now 3D doesn't suck.
Wait, well, if now they can you're make talking it work. About 360 3D, well, which is something else.
I want this to happen now.
Do we just have to spin in circles in order to just see the back of the...
That's a good point.
Yeah.
Maybe there could be a button that allows you to turn the phone instead of having it track your head.
We could hit Mayday and be like, could you spin that for me in 3D?
We've redesigned this rumored device for them now. I think we fixed it. Great.
It's like the new, you know, Bluetooth headsets where people seem like they're talking to themselves, just people spinning in crosswalks. Gotta see the back of this media console.
Got an Amazon phone, obviously. meanwhile, Facebook building a village. It takes a village. What's going on?
Yeah, Facebook doesn't want its employees to go home. In order to help them stay, Facebook is working with a local developer down in Menlo Park, where its headquarters are, to build a housing community of 394 units. It'll cost about $120 million right next to its headquarters. It's called Anton Menlo. That's the developer's name. It's Anton something company, so... That's not a name of a new Facebook phone or anything. It'll be a 630,000 square foot rental property, and we'll have some cool amenities like daycare for dogs and a sports bar. Now, the company says that the apartments will go for market rates, which is super scary because the market rates right now in the Bay Area are extremely high. But a handful will be set aside for low-income residents. All of the units, except 15, will be open to non-Facebook employees. So it's not like, oh, you have to work here, or you have to work at Facebook if you work here or if you live here. But in general, that's, you know, who it's made for. John Tenanes, who's Facebook's director of real estate, says the beauty of this thing is that it's extremely close to our campus. It's a 5-minute bike ride, and he notes that it's along a dedicated path. You look at the San Francisco Bay as you ride to and from work. I don't know. I mean, it sounds like the old company town model where a town is sort of built around, I don't know, the mining facility or the manufacturing plant, you know, back in the, you know, the auto industry boom. But how does this work as well when Facebook doesn't have lifers? No one's really expected to work at Facebook forever. Scott, what do you think?
This reminds me of Hershey, Pennsylvania a little bit. Mm-hmm. And that Disney town that Disney tried to create. The fly in the ointment is exactly what Sarah just said, that you don't have lifers necessarily, but it's a really interesting idea, especially since they're rental places, to maybe say, all right, while you're starting at Facebook, you can rent here for a number of months or whatever, enjoy all these amenities, and then, I don't know, you know, save up some money, cash in some stock, whatever, get yourself, you know, your own place. It's part of what Facebook is doing also to help Menlo Park, and that's where I believe the low-income housing comes in. Facebook has said it will have at least 15 units of low-income housing. It's helping Menlo Park to develop because it's got all this space. But it'll be interesting because we haven't seen that much here in the Bay Area of what Sarah exactly calls a company town. And it'll be interesting to see if that catches on among Facebook employees. Do they really want to live that close? Or if it's just kind of a cool new place for young people to live in Menlo Park.
Yeah, Facebook doesn't seem to have lifers now, but the thing is, would they have lifers if they were provided with housing? So the thing is, if you're always, if you actually have this good feeling towards Facebook and you're like, well, I have work right there, I can go 5 minutes, that kind of morale boost could be pretty big. Maybe people wouldn't be jumping around as much when it comes to Facebook, although that's just the nature of the business that people leave all the time. But I think this could create a different culture in this kind of environment, because if you have your company bothering to give you housing, you might think twice about leaving.
You're going to have it full of people from Google and Zynga because it's open to people who are non-Facebook employees. It's just going to be a nest of spies.
Also, imagine the benefits packages. You know, I mean, so many engineers and designers and top talent that a company like Facebook really wants to keep these people because there's a lot of competition. So you sort of like, okay, well, here's our very generous medical benefits. Plus, we'll give you, you know, 3 months rent free for the first year. So you're kind of signing a lease. Plus, you're signing a contract. I don't know. It could be pretty attractive. I'm in.
It's unconfirmed whether it comes with locks on the doors or whether you have to enable those by finding a hidden room somewhere.
Oh, no, you're opted in to everything when you come in there. Yeah. You're opted into AC on all the time.
Oh, do you not want us to have a copy of your keys?
You should have told us that. Yeah, that's
good. Sound in the storage.
It's all glass, too.
Yeah, it's entirely made of glass.
There's that.
All right, let's take a quick break and thank our other sponsor for today's show, Personal Capital. Here's the catch-22 of your financial life. I wish I knew this more, but as you get more successful with finances, it gets more complicated. You have a checking account, and then you have a savings account, and then you have a retirement account, and then you have a credit card, and then maybe you start doing investments, and then you get a mortgage, and you've got a loan. It's hard to make great decisions about your money when you're only seeing one piece of the puzzle at a time. You'll make mistakes because you don't have all of the intelligence. Personal Capital changes the game by combining all your financial accounts and giving you a total real-time snapshot of all your finances. You'll get your graphs, charts, reports. They'll tell you the whole story. It's like they call it having a financial GPS at your fingertips. Right now, you can use Personal Capital for free, too. Go to personalcapital.com/TNT. Sign up. Just takes a minute. It'll pay you big dividends by helping you make better investment decisions immediately. And your financial life is probably not going to get less complicated. So why wait? Sign up now. Absolutely free. PersonalCapital.com/TNT. Get your free Personal Capital account. Smart investing means seeing the big picture. So start today. Visit personalcapital.com/TNT. And, you know, we had the founder of Personal Capital and Triangulation. Great guy and really interesting website. So go check it out. Personal Capital. We thank them for their support of Tech News Today. Deutsche Bank is saying, don't worry about the Tesla that you saw catching on fire in the news fuse. Here's what's going on with this story. A Tesla S, according to the driver, collided with debris on Washington State Route 167, 8 a.m. yesterday. Some folks driving by happened to capture it on video. Tesla says it was a large metal object that struck the car, caused the fire. They stressed that by design, the fire was limited to the front part of the car. The video made it to Jalopnik. At the same time, as we mentioned in the news fuse, analyst Ben Callow at RW Baird downgraded the stock from outperform to neutral, telling the investors that he's still bullish on Tesla's long-term prospects, but the company has some significant milestones he thinks are already built in the price over the next 18 months, and he just wants to make sure they achieve those milestones. Things like putting out the SUV, things like that, shipping all the cars that they've promised. Because of the perception of the fire in the public and because of the downgrade, Tesla stock took a 6.24% dip, falling $12.05 a share. Now, that closing price yesterday was $180.95. The stock's been up 400% since the beginning of the year, so it's not a horrible situation overall for Tesla. And Deutsche Telekom offered some reasons to say that the risk is mitigated here. The fire incident seems to be equal to internal combustion vehicles. When you look at the number of miles driven of Tesla cars compared to the number of miles driven and the incidents of fires in internal combustion. It's 83 million miles of Model S driving, 12 significant accidents, extreme crash testing by U.S. safety regulators. This is the first fire in a Tesla vehicle. Also, I posted this on Twitter earlier today. I just went and I was like, okay, well, how many YouTube videos are there of gas-powered cars catching fire? I found this one, which is pretty impressive. It just happened back in May. That's a much more serious fire than the one on the Tesla because it's consuming the whole car. And you have a gasoline tank that can explode here. But look over to the right on this YouTube page. This is what stunned me. All of these other car fires for gas-powered cars over there. All right. So I hope we've reset the sort of reaction to seeing a Tesla on fire. Scott, how much do you think we should worry about this sort of thing?
Well, I like what you said at the end. I mean, in the news business, we love a good car fire, and we've covered many, many of them. I wouldn't worry so much that the car caught on fire. Yes, it was a rough day for Tesla. You started the day with a downgrade, and then you ended the day with this viral video of a car fire. But you're right. Other cars catch on fire once in a while. It's very unfortunate. Their stock prices don't go down. I think the big worry if you're an investor in Tesla right now is that you own a stock that went from 26 to 190 very, very quickly. Impressive numbers, bright future, really good product, but that's a really, really big jump. And when you're at that kind of a stratospheric level, you tend to have $10 and $12 and $15 moves up and down, and that's part of what you do when you invest in a growth, sexy, non-proven company. When it comes to Wall Street, just yet, it hasn't been public for all that long. So I understand the hesitation, but if I'm a long-term investor in Tesla, I am not at all worried about the video that went around. I'm more concerned with the next earning report to see if they can continue to sell a whole bunch of Model S's and to find out how close they are to rolling out the Model X as well. I think with Tesla, it's still a product-driven stock price and a product-driven story, not so much a YouTube video of a car fire.
I don't know. We've seen Tesla kind of react strongly when there's bad PR. I think there was like a feud with a newspaper, which is escaping me right now, with Tesla.
Right.
And the idea was that this guy ran out of juice by a certain point in the East Coast.
And Elon Musk said, "We watched you do donuts in a parking lot."
Exactly. So this kind of thing of there's a fire and Tesla being an unproven brand, they want to make sure that their cars aren't perceived as any more dangerous than any other car. Obviously, when you see a car on fire, that'll freak you out. And if you're going to pay that much money for a vehicle, you don't want this to happen. But that can happen to any car. So the idea of how they're going to not spin this, but control the PR that's going to come out of this, all the press that's going to jump on this, the question is there anything that happened that was unusual about this car fire? And the Tesla is saying that the driver was able to leave and everything went to plan because they are planned for these kinds of things. Fires are planned for, crashes are planned for. It's not like Tesla was thinking, what if a car goes on fire? Everybody thinks that.
Yeah, I think, Tom, you point out the YouTube videos and, you know, all of those videos that you saw on YouTube have titles like, whoa, car catches fire because it's unusual. It's something that does happen to gasoline-powered cars, but it's not like, I mean, if you see it, you're like, that's crazy. It doesn't happen that often. What remains to be seen is Tesla any more likely to have fire problems regularly? If so, you can't be asking people to pay $100,000 for a car that's more likely to catch on fire. And I don't know that you know that with a car company that's so new.
Yeah, I think that you've summed it up perfectly. It's one incident, and you can't tell too much. You can't tell that it's perfectly safe just from the one incident. You have to look at other factors like crash tests and safety tests, and you have to wait to see if there are other incidents before you can draw a conclusion. Snapchat is well known for being the thing that you send and then it disappears unless people do hacky stuff. But it's designed for ephemeral communications. But they're changing that, Sarah. Why would they do that?
Well, they're not changing the way Snapchat works. They see 350 million snaps sent per day. And that's because people like the product as is. But they are introducing a new feature called Snapchat Stories. We talked about it a little bit in the news views. What you do is you create a story for yourself as you're sort of going along your day in a 24-hour period so that when you take a photo, so for example, if I was just going to, you know, take like a little selfie of me, oh, that's not attractive. I could go ahead and then say, all right, I'm going to send it to some friends here, or I'm going to add it to the story that I've already started creating. Add. Okay. Now I've got a story up top that when you click, you can see a variety of things. I took a picture of my cat earlier this morning, then a picture of the coffee I was drinking when I was working on the news views at home before I left and was late to work. And there's the rundown. And so I can sort of be like, oh, cool. Sarah's, I can see just stuff that she's doing, peppering throughout the day, but it won't be there tomorrow. You can watch it as many times as you want in that 24-hour period, but it's like, here's my day. Once the day is over, it's gone for good. So what doesn't change is that this every piece of the story is always, you can guarantee, just less than a day old. It's happening basically right now. So it's a little paper trail. But it does change for anybody who's really familiar with Snapchat. I mean, sometimes my friends and I love Snapchat, by the way. I'll just say that right now. We send each other stupid stuff. You know, we, you know, draw on people's faces and that sort of thing. And it's really not ever meant to be seen more than just that first 3 seconds. So you do kind of have to think about it. Wait a second. Am I sending this to people who, I don't know, could use it against me or watch it one too many times, or it does change things somewhat. But the team thought that a send all button could just kind of destroy Snapchat, too spammy type of a thing. So this kind of gets around that. You have your day where everybody who's your friend on Snapchat can see what you've been up to and revisit it and see what you've added to it. But you've still got the one-on-one Snapchat functionality. I know it all sounds a little silly, but hey, you can't argue with 350 million snaps per day. Scott, what do you think? Is this the right move for the company?
Yes, because you can't argue with those numbers, Sarah. I mean, a super popular social network gives you a new way to share. Bonanza, done. End of story. That's your marketing right there. Instagram gave us a new way to do a video. Twitter gave us Vine. And all these things are successful. And yes, the young people, like Sarah, will take to this very quickly. And again, a new way to share on a social network. What could possibly go wrong there?
I think this actually fits. I was a little skeptical when I first saw this story. But what Snapchat's is saying is we know that people are using it for unimportant things, but not necessarily always embarrassing things. So we're going to leave it so that if you're doing the like really crazy thing you don't want to last more than a few seconds, you can still do that. But maybe over the course of the day, because I get them from friends who are like, on my way to work, you know, like just funny stuff that's not embarrassing. But yeah, that could become a story over the course of the day. And then that still disappears. So it's still generally in the spirit of Snapchat. Makes sense to me.
It's like a way to convince people to look at a slideshow. It's kind of like, okay, the old days you sit in the room. Okay, well, I'll watch the slides from the vacation, but at least it's only 24 hours here. You're going to see this story of a day. It's like an expiring timeline, right? So this is kind of it's kind of nice to have that, I'd imagine.
It really is something like a Facebook newsfeed competitor, mm-hmm. because it's sort of the same thing. I mean, this is all stuff that I could be tweeting about, or I could be taking photos of and adding to Facebook. But it just works fundamentally. It's completely the opposite. It's most of this stuff just doesn't need to be put into little vaults anywhere or categorized or organized or kept forever on a server farm somewhere. It's just something that is relevant for a short period of time and then gone.
Like the Snapchat I sent Sarah during
that was a good one, by the way. Could you make that face again, or is that just
I don't know if I can. It might hurt.
It looked like it hurt. But it's gone. I can't show you guys. It's just gone.
I couldn't find. I don't think I have the story button yet. It's not there. Let's finish up with Flutter, and that is a gesture recognition company that Google just snapped up.
Yeah, so Flutter software lets Windows and Mac users control music and movies with their desktop. If you wave your hand in front of your camera, you could play and pause music. The Mac app's $5. There's also a Flutter extension for Chrome, so if you want to control things like Netflix, YouTube, Grooveshark, it also works. As long as you have the app, it'll still work with your browser. Now, Flutter CEO Navneet Dalal said, "We will be continuing our research at Google," so they're going to be working there. Scott, easy question. Which Google products do you think could best integrate Flutter? Which ones do you want to wave at?
I see a lot of this, and we've tested a couple of these kind of things, and it is kind of fun to try out. I think this could change how we mess around with Gmail, certainly in the App Store, Google Play, maybe even a little bit when you're moving things around. And now the name escapes me, but I think it's Google Docs, and sharing things back and forth. And something like what we're doing now, and just scrolling through articles and passing things back and forth, and shopping, this could be a new way to play and sort of check things out on the web. Again, we've seen a couple of companies that are doing this already, and it's a fun thing. It would be interesting to see this get past the gimmick stage and turn into a real, where you turn in a real remote control. And again, this is sort of the future of gaming. Microsoft has brought this out with the Kinect, and I wouldn't be surprised to see if this really takes off to the point where we are jumping from the touchscreen mobile devices to just the gesture screen on a laptop or a desktop.
Yeah, I have the Leap Motion, and I used it as a novelty, but I don't find myself compelled to go back and plug it in all the time. Maybe that's because it needs to be plugged in. Maybe if I always had it available built in, I might try to use it more. I feel like immediately Chromecast is the one that jumps to my mind, as them trying to say, like the Kinect, I could, wave my arms around and get Netflix to play somehow. Everybody's trying to figure out how to make gestures work. And I think, like everything else, we'll find instances where they are better than current input methods and instances where they aren't. And we'll settle into those eventually, and it'll seem like normal.
Yeah, unlike the Leap, which requires a separate piece of hardware that tracks lots of motions, the Flutter uses your webcam. So that means anything that has a webcam theoretically would be able to be controllable using this. I'm just kind of curious, will Android get some of these functions? Although it seems a little strange to wave over your phone. We've seen Samsung, they really love that feature. They have this idea of you can kind of hover over the screen. If you can replicate some of those things using your webcam, that might be a cheap alternative to that. As for Chromecast, it would also obviously need another camera. So I'm thinking on the operating system level, Chrome OS, Android, these things might start having a lot more functionality just because you can wave around with play, pause, and all that kind of stuff.
And with the Amazon phone, you'll be able to levitate 3D objects just by waving at them. Oh. So think way ahead in the future. We can bring it all back to that.
I was going to say the exact same thing, Scott. You sorry. Like great minds think alike. Exactly. All right, let's finish up with a randomizer. Even though we just finished up. Segway foul. You can call on me. 10 yards. Today we had a randomizer poll between two items. One, submitted to our subreddit by Captain Kipper, was table made of a floating matrix of wooden blocks with embedded magnets. That got 34% of the vote. But beating it handily was note to Scott's submission on the subreddit. So someone called the house today saying that there was malicious software on my computer, having a Mac, and knowing this was a scam, I had to have some fun. Here is the audio. And we're not going to play the whole thing. We will have the link in the show notes if you want to listen to it. It is pretty funny. If you haven't heard these kinds of scams, they call you and they try to trick you into installing malware by visiting an infected website. And then they usually hijack it and say, well, you have to pay money to get your computer back. So check out this little bit of the conversation here.
When I pulled up the website, the Google search bar actually said this was a scam. Can you explain that? This actually, when I searched this website, it said that the website was not safe. Uh-huh. And it said it was a scam. Can you explain that?
No, sir. You are wise enough to understand that if I am a scammer, I do not tell such things. Okay?
So if you're not a scammer, you don't...
If you're wise enough, you'll know I'm not a scammer, obviously, or I wouldn't be calling you. Wow. It gets better from there.
Oh, so. I love that. Arguing with a scammer.
It's become poetry, kind of really. A hobby. Ars Technica had a big article where they entertained a guy, and it was the same situation with the Mac for a long time. So it's not the first time this has happened, but apparently never gets old for our audience. Let's see what's on the calendar.
Let's. The ZTE Grand S and Nubia 5. Sounds awful. Are going to be ready for pre-order on Saturday, October 5th. Nubia 5? Oh, well. Okay. Target is launching a prepaid mobile service on the T-Mobile's network on Sunday, October 6th. Also on the 6th, Samsung's HomeSync Android TV box is coming to stores. And then looking ahead to November 1st, the Memoto Life blogging camera has been renamed to The Narrative, and it will be shipping November 1st ahead of schedule.
Time to start life logging.
Yeah.
And then send us an email about it, like these people did in our incoming section.
Incoming message.
These people will be Andrew today. Hey, TNT gang. Great discussion yesterday regarding Freedom Pop. You rightly pointed out the handicaps hindering MVNOs. However, Sprint's WiMAX network may not be as feeble as IA suggests. The network, while weak and spotty on the West Coast, covers a solid portion of the urban areas across the Northeast Corridor. I use a Clear Voyager hotspot as my primary ISP. $50 a month gets me unlimited data for all my devices. I'm a cord cutter and use 200 gigabytes a month on average. According to Google, I spend 90% of my time at home, work, and along the transit routes in between, where coverage is good, making the value incredible. If I ditch my AT&T iPhone for Freedom Pop, I would save $1,000 a year. That wow. may be worth suffering the indignity of pulling out an HTC Evo to make a call. I hope Freedom Pop and the other MVNOs build an option acceptable to as many people as possible.
I was already early in this reading this email to say, like, well, that's one person. One person doesn't, you know, actually make for a good sample. And WiMAX is eventually going to go away. So this, you know, it's not going to grow in coverage. But when he says I'm going to save $1,000, boom. Yeah, I'm with you, man. Good on you, Andrew. That's a huge difference. That really sets it apart. And that brings us to the end of our show. Thank you all for watching or listening. Scott Budman, thank you for joining us. Always great to have you along. Let folks know where they can find you online and follow your work.
Well, thank you. Always good to be here. Posting on Twitter at Scott Budman on the News 5 and 6. And again, always glad to be here. And might have to check out that Nubia 5, although I think they peaked around Nubia 3. But we'll check it out.
They're all Nubias to me. Thank you, Scott.
No disrespect to the sedan, by the way, with of that course. Comment. Nope.
Thank you. Also, thank you. Folks, don't forget about our subreddit, technewstoday.reddit.com. It's a place where you can let us know, not just randomizers like we had today. Actually, we get submissions from all kinds of stories, and we take a look at them. The Snowden story was submitted. The number of people upvoting or downvoting those stories does have an effect on how we do our lineup. So go get in there and participate, technewstoday.reddit.com. You can find us on the web at twit.tv/TNT. You can email us, tnt@twit.tv, and give us a call, 260-TNT-SHOW. Darren Kitchen and Len Peralta illustrating the show will be with us tomorrow. We'll see you then.
Sent you a good Snapchat.